Brave New World.
Hello and welcome to Brave New World programme, John Harrison. Now, we've all heard of Eurasia, but how many of us actually know what it is and where it is? The word would seem to indicate a grouping of countries linking Europe and Asia. But where does Europe start and finish? And where does Asia begin? How does Russia see Eurasia? And perhaps more to the point, how does Asia see Russia? To try and do the impossible and answer these and many more related questions in the space of 15 minutes, I welcome to the programme Jeff Schubert, a visiting professor at Moscow's High School of Economics. Welcome to the studio in Moscow, Jeff.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, in general terms, how does Russia see Eurasia geographically? And how does this differ from Western basic understanding of what Eurasia is, if it differs, that is?
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Some, in Russia, you mean?
In Russia, yes.
Okay. Right.
I mean, some people have a view that it basically consists of the Eurasian Economic Union and much more. The Eurasian Economic Union being Russia, Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. And these people tend to think of Eurasia in economic terms.
Mm-hmm.
The other people, such as Sergei Karaganov at the High School of Economics, who tends to see Eurasia in much broader terms, even encompassing countries of Western Europe and moving as far across east as Japan. And they have a slightly different view. They tend to see Eurasia as a geopolitical entity rather than just straight economics. Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, in fact goes so far as in some statements to actually include ASEAN countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Countries, which includes Vietnam, Indonesia, etc. So it depends on who you speak to and what perspectives they bring to the way they think about it.
Okay, so at the moment it's quite a fluid term. Its borders of this concept Eurasia haven't really set yet in concrete and stone. We're talking about a vague concept. Now, presumably, the sort of different views that Russia has of Eurasia are also echoed by people's perception of Russia within Eurasia from Asia. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not too sure that the Chinese really think about Eurasia in terms of Eurasia as such. I mean, one well-known Russian expert says that he thinks that the Chinese actually regard Eurasia as the Wild West, the equivalent of the Wild West.
So
some strange concept and some place to be explored, but they don't really see themselves as part of it. And I think it's pretty clear from the words of Xi Jinping, certainly now that there's a Congress on in Beijing and looking at the future, and his various statements and his speeches about the future suggests that really China doesn't see itself in any way as a Eurasian entity and never will. I think the Chinese are much more ambitious and they see themselves as the coming world power, and their One Belt, One Road or Belt and Road initiative is really about going out to the world and is certainly not restricted to Eurasia.
Wow. Okay, so that's quite a different view of things, isn't it, that we perhaps are not aware of from day-to-day level, that the ambitions of China may be different from the ambitions of Russia in this respect. Let's take a step back. What I find fascinating with the whole debate is that Russia's talking about Eurasia. Now, if I hear you right, Eurasia also includes Western Europe? Is that right?
Certainly in the view of Sergei Karaganov at the High School of Economics and some of the initial statements of Vladimir Putin before the Ukrainian issue arose, certainly included Western Europe. He spoke about a free trade zone, if you like, ranging from Lisbon on the Atlantic to Vladivostok in the Russian Far East. Interestingly enough, though, he never included Japan in it, and that is an interesting issue. But since the Ukraine issue arose and the Crimean issue arose, I think the conversation, at least from the point of view of Vladimir Putin, has more moved away from Western Europe, now includes Russia, Central Asia, or particularly the Eurasian Economic Union, which is very important in his view, plus China and China's One Belt, One Road, or certainly the Silk Road, the land part of One Belt, One Road, and he even extends its remit to ASEAN countries. So he talks about a possible cooperation, economic cooperation area involving the Eurasian Economic Union in partnership, always in partnership with China and the possibly the Association of Southeast Asian Nations.
Now, there's also, of course, the whole question of finances, of economics. Now, how does this new idea of Eurasia pan out in terms of who's going to pay for it and how does it work in trade terms? Is envisaged there to be a vast free trade zone or what?
It depends on which...
Which version you take, okay.
If you take the narrow view, the very economics-orientated view associated with the Eurasian Economic Union, that is including the Central Asian countries, basically, and Russia, Armenia, and Belarus, you're thinking about not so much external finance, but finance derived from different economic policies, and in particular, Yaroslav Lisolovic, from the Eurasian Development Bank, talks about autarky or an industrial policy. An industrial policy, not so much on import substitution, but an industrial policy orientated towards exports. And he gives the Korean, South Korean industrialization experience as an example of that. So that is finance coming from internal good economic policies. But some broader views, for example, the Sergei Karaganov view, tends to see China providing the money for the development of much of Eurasia, certainly the Central Eurasian countries, possibly Iran, etc., and Russia providing the security, the military force of the security. And I think when it comes down to it, some of these people would say, look, Russia has exhibited that it can and is willing to use force in places like Syria and, God, we have to say it, Crimea, and that experience could be useful in the Eurasian area. And they would say, these people would say that China doesn't necessarily have experience or the desire to use military force anyway. Now, that might be changing in my view, but that is their story.
Absolutely incredibly interesting. Let's take a short break here. Welcome back to Brave New World Programme. Today I'm talking to Jeff Schubert, a visiting professor at the High School of Economics, about Russia's new understanding involvement within a new block of countries termed Eurasia. One Belt, One Road concept is very Chinese, isn't it? It doesn't really fit in with what Russia envisages, the Eurasian Economic Union. And is there a conflict here?
I think there is, ultimately. And in fact, One Belt, One Road, conceptually, at least, see, there's the Silk Road Economic Belt, which is the land part of One Belt, One Road. Then you've got the Maritime Silk Road, which goes down through the Indian Ocean, etc. But talking about the Silk Road Economic Belt, the land part, it doesn't necessarily involve Russia. It probably will to some degree, but other countries are just as important. I think Kazakhstan, for example, is very important for One Belt, One Road, or the Silk Road Economic part of it, because Kazakhstan is a direct supplier of energy and other raw materials, but also the pipelines bringing gas from Turkmenistan run through Kazakhstan.
Yeah. So for this to happen, this Eurasian vision, dream, whatever you call it, to happen, it means that a country like Kazakhstan has got to decide on its allegiances, basically, whether it's to Russia, whether it's to China, or whether it's to the new Eurasia. And that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and I don't think they're going to do that or want to do it. I mean, they know they are stuck between two giants, Russia and China. So they will do the best they can. They will, to a certain extent, play the game within the Eurasian Economic Union. But at the same time, while they are saying they're willing to negotiate with China as part of the Eurasian Economic Union, they do come to many bilateral agreements with China. And Kyrgyzstan is also doing that, as well as Belarus. But Kazakhstan is really in the central position here.
Yeah, okay. That's quite a controversial subject, I should imagine. Now, perhaps even more controversial is the whole issue of the third man in the room. All this talk about Russia and China, you know, building bridges and harmonizing as trade and political relations, never becoming allies in the strategic sense, but becoming partners in military terms. Is this all because of American foreign policy, what's perceived to be a rather dangerous and reckless approach being taken by the US in China and Russia, and an attempt to counterbalance all that?
I think it certainly is, and it's not only just recently that this view has been formed. This predates Donald Trump. I mean, the expansion of NATO, I think, was seen...
I'm sorry, I can't actually imagine anything predating Donald Trump. It seems to be just going on
I think if we go back even to Bill Clinton, but after the fall of the Berlin Wall, or the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think many Russians thought that there would not be an expansion of NATO, but there was. And quite legitimately, I think they feared that NATO could eventually end up in some places as Sevastopol. So... that fear caused a reaction within Russia. And I think the pivot to Asia undertaken by the Obama administration in terms of supposedly moving its military forces away from the Middle East towards East Asia also heightened Chinese fears of what could happen to their trade routes. For example, they are very dependent on trade through the South China Sea, and particularly for energy imports. And I think this has been one reason why the Chinese have been fairly aggressive in reclaiming or building islands. I think really when energy security is probably the main driver here for One Belt, One Road, even through Asia, as I've already mentioned, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, but the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which connects China to the Indian Ocean via Pakistan, is another possible or very important way of importing energy from the Middle East.
So you could see this in a way that is a natural reaction to what some people perceive in Russia and China to be U.S. aggression. I don't know what else to call it. I mean, let's get together, boys. Let's somehow band together and project, at least project an image that we're actually going to come together, you know, and if we come together, sorry, you know, you're out of the game. Now, the question is, can we, rather they, come together? I sense that you're doubting that it's actually going to happen.
Well, I think there are several issues. One is at the political level, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping obviously get on together very well. They both have great ambitions for their countries. But ultimately, of course, China and Russia can be, and most likely will be at some stage, competitors in the Central Asian area, competitors for influence. But also at the lower level, apart from some major energy deals and a few major metals deals and a few individual investments, the business relationship and the society relationship, people-to-people relationship between Russia and China is not strong. And I think, you know, there's various reasons for that, including languages and history, etc. But also people in those countries do find it easier to look to the west. The Chinese look east to the west.
That's right.
And the Russians look west to the west.
That's that. Two people looking in the same direction, but looking in totally different directions at the same time.
That's right.
It's a lovely cartoon, that. Now, how does this, the Valdai School, we hear about in Russia quite a lot. Every year there's a sort of retreat up in North Russia where all these economists gather.
It's happening today. It's been happening the last few days.
How does that fit into this whole discussion?
The Valdai Discussion Club, particularly under the influence of Sergei Karaganov, has been the main intellectual driving force of this Eurasia concept. I think in other parts of the Russian intellectual elite and political elite, Eurasia is considered a pretty dubious concept, but there's certain people who are very enthusiastic about it, particularly the many people in the Valdai Discussion Club. So Valdai have keep writing reports about it, and I sense a certain frustration that they keep saying this should happen, we need to do this to make it happen, but they're a bit less clear that it will happen. But also they do perceive this Eurasia as a chance to develop Siberia and the Russian Far East, because Eurasia,
it's also huge, isn't it?
Because Russia has had trouble developing those two areas and they have very sparse populations. But if they're transit routes or providers of raw material or even fresh water, which some Eurasianists talk about, that those areas could be developed. So it really depends on a whole variety of factors.
I'm going to have to stop here. Unfortunately, we've completely run out of time. I think we are going to have to be back on again, Jeff, to talk about this and other related issues in more detail. Thank you very much indeed, Jeff Schubert, visiting professor at the Moscow Higher School of Economics. And thank you very much to listeners for being with us today. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.